Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the October 22nd, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing shows a giant Chinese leader, Xi Jinping. He's wearing his traditional dark suit, and he's marching confidently toward the shore. He's actually in the ocean. Around him are dozens of fighter planes and looks like military ships all following in around him. The headline is Xi's threat to take Taiwan. How should the U.S. try to deter China from invading? And that's our first main story. China's escalating threats to Taiwan. What happened? China stepped up its campaign of military threats and incendiary rhetoric toward Taiwan this week, sparking a renewed debate in Washington over how to deter a possible Chinese invasion of the U.S.'s democratic ally. As Beijing sent waves of 150 fighter jets and bombers across the Taiwan Straits into Taiwan's air defense identification zone, the Wall Street Journal revealed that U.S. Marines have been on the ground in Taiwan for at least a year, training troops to repel an invasion. Chinese leader Xi Jinping, whose government considers the island nation part of its sovereign territory, reiterated his call for peaceful unification, but refused to rule out the use of force. Taiwan's defense minister warned that China is ramping up its military for a full-scale invasion by 2025. Taiwan's only option, said President Tsai Ing-wen, is to make ourselves stronger, more united, and more resolute in our determination to protect ourselves. President Biden tried to defuse escalating tensions by saying he and Xi had agreed to abide by the Taiwan Agreement. This was an apparent reference to a 1979 statement at the time Beijing and Washington were establishing diplomatic relations, in which the U.S. acknowledged, but did not endorse, Beijing's claim there is one China. The U.S. has provided billions in military aid to Taiwan, but takes no official position on its sovereignty and has never said whether the U.S. will defend it by force. The policy of strategic ambiguity may be tested by Xi's increasingly aggressive rhetoric about the inevitability of Taiwan succumbing to Beijing's rule. A thriving democracy of 23 million people, Taiwan produces most of the world's semiconductors. What the editorial said: every act of Chinese intimidation raises the risk of an accident or miscalculation, said the Boston Globe. For daring to build ties with the West through trade and military exercises, democratic Taiwan finds itself under siege. When Washington established diplomatic ties with Beijing in 1979, it passed the Taiwan Relations Act, a foundational law that has allowed the U.S. to supply most of Taiwan's weaponry. Still, Taiwan needs more reassurance from Biden that the U.S. won't abandon it to fight Goliath on its own. The U.S. should back up its commitments by providing far more military aid to Taiwan, said the Washington Post. Recent Pentagon war games have shown U.S. capabilities might not be sufficient to defeat a Chinese invasion. Taiwan has watched Xi's crushing of Hong Kong's free institutions and knows China's intentions are not benign, but it needs more help from Washington to build a military that will serve as real deterrence. Investing in hard power assets for Taiwan would impress China, more than even the sternest words. What the columnists said. Some China hawks have called for the U.S. to provide an explicit security guarantee to Taiwan, said Teresa Shaheen in NationalReview.com. But China would see that as a challenge and might respond by invading. Without making provocative declarations, Biden should deepen diplomatic and military engagement with Taiwan, making it clear that Taiwan is a friend of democratic free market countries and the People's Republic of China is not. Let's not overreact to China's largely symbolic military incursions, said Daniel DePetris in NBCNews.com. China frequently buzzes Taiwan's airspace as a way of communicating displeasure to adversaries and competitors, such as when Washington sent multiple cabinet officials to Taiwan last year. But there is no evidence Xi really wants an actual war. An invasion could produce embarrassing losses, turn Beijing into an international pariah overnight, and devastate its trade-dependent economy. For the U.S., stumbling into a shooting war with the nuclear-armed China would be opening a Pandora's box. So we must keep a level head. Xi and China now face serious economic problems, said Dean Ching in the New York Post. Many Chinese are experiencing power outages as winter approaches due to a coal shortage. China also faces a crisis in its debt-addled real estate market after the collapse of developer Evergrande, leaving millions of Chinese high and dry and resentful. As things grow worse, Xi may ratchet up his nationalistic saber-rattling to help mute critics and reinforce his own standing. Beware, a wounded dragon is a dangerous one. Our controversy of the week is school boards, the culture war's new front line. When America's school boards start calling in the feds, you know we're in a bad place, said Karen Ataya in the Washington Post. Answering a desperate plea from the National School Boards Association, the NSBA, Attorney General Merrick Garland last week asked the FBI to develop strategies to handle what he called a disturbing spike in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence against teachers and school board members across the nation. Conservatives accused Garland of criminalizing dissent, but we've all seen the outrageous images of red-faced parents screaming threats at board meetings and jabbing fingers in teachers' faces over mask mandates and claims they are indoctrinating kids with critical race theory. One Ohio school board member received a letter calling him a filthy traitor and warning, "We are coming after you." Brevard County, Florida, school board member Jennifer Jenkins said enraged parents have staked out her home, followed her car, and told her she would need to beg for mercy. Parents have a right to be heard, of course, said Margaret Talbot in TheNewYorker.com. But the current crop of school board protesters spout misinformation, shout down all opposing views, and are fairly vibrating with January 6 energy. The left is making a mountain out of a molehill here, said Nicholas Tampio in USA Today. In its appeal for federal help, the NSBA called school board protests a form of domestic terrorism, but provided no evidence to support that hysterical claim. Shouting F-bombs is not nice, but it's not terrorism. In the letter's only claim of actual violence, an Illinois man allegedly punched a board member and was promptly arrested. Garland knows the FBI's job is to investigate serious crimes against the United States, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Not angry talk at local school board meetings. This is blatantly partisan attempt to silence conservative parents by raising the specter of government retaliation. It's not just conservatives, said Maud Moran in BarryWeiss.substack.com. There are plenty of lifelong liberals like myself alarmed at what ideological zealots are teaching our children. If I don't want my kids taught that everyone is defined by their race or that biological sex is not real, what recourse do I have but to go express my opposition at a school board meeting? That's not domestic terrorism, it's good parenting. Raucous school board meetings are a feature, not a bug, of American life, said Selena Zito in WashingtonExaminer.com. In politically diverse communities with a single public education system, parents will inevitably have passionate views about how schools are run. It is downright chilling that they must now wonder if their names will wind up in an FBI database. This is not the first time public schools have been the flashpoints for larger cultural battles, said Adam Latz in the WashingtonPost.com. In the 1920s, parents rose up against the teaching of evolution. In the 1960s and 70s, parents were furious that long-haired kids were allowed to question authority, mix with friends of different races, and kiss in public, all of which was deemed anti-American and anti-Christian. These national panics are better understood as a politics of petulance, explosions of rage and frustration from people who see the world changing and want to turn the clock back. Parents do have the right to voice their concerns about public schools, said Ruben Navarrete, Jr. in thedailybeast.com. But teachers, administrators, and school board members also have rights. Chief among them is the right not to be terrorized by citizens run amok. It was a good week for mysteries. After numerous New Hampshire residents reported their homes were shaken by a large, prolonged series of booms. No seismic activity was detected. Satellite imagery suggested a meteor may have exploded over the state. It was a good week for new legal ground. After a deaf man, Robert Sowell, 35, of Florida, was charged with sending a video clip with a sign language death threat. Police translated Sal's exact words as, "I'll kill you, okay? I'll kill you." It was a good week for going green, with Britain's Prince Charles revealing that he uses white wine and cheese byproducts as fuel for his vintage Aston Martin. Charles claims the sports car runs better and is more powerful than when it ran on gasoline. But it was a bad week for desperation after Reverend Sarah Yetman, the vicar of St. Michael's, a 150-year-old Anglican church in England, changed the church's name to St. Mike's and added a coffee bar. "We aim to reach out to more young people," Yetman explained. It was a bad week for Singapore, where authorities tested out mobile anti-crime surveillance robots to patrol the streets. "It brings to mind a dystopian world of robots," said resident Franny Teo, age 34. And it was a bad week for sticking it to the man after Alan West, an anti-vax Texas former congressman now battling COVID-19, tweeted from his hospital bed that instead of enriching the pockets of Big Pharma with vaccinations, we should focus on monoclonal antibody therapy. Critics noted that a vaccine dose cost the government $20, while monoclonal antibodies enrich Big Pharma by $2,100 per patient. Short and other news piece. U.S. stops workplace immigration raids. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas ordered U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement this week to halt large-scale immigration arrest at job sites. Mayorkas said the agency will instead target employers who violate labor laws and will ensure that workers who report labor violations won't risk facing deportation. ICE raids have aimed at industries that employ large numbers of undocumented immigrants. In 2019, the Trump administration swept up 680 workers at seven food processing plants in Mississippi. but Trump's administration was slower than Obama's to prosecute companies for immigration issues. And Mayorkas said cracking down on exploitative employers will benefit their business competitors who abide by the law. Title of the briefing this week is Out of Stock. Supply chain problems are causing major shortages of consumer products just as the holiday shopping season begins. What's wrong with the supply chain? Bottlenecks caused by the pandemic are clogging the global supply chain, leading to shortages and extended delays in delivering a wide range of consumer goods, including dishwashers, refrigerators, computer chips, furniture, clothing, toys, and even books. With consumers wanting to spend money they accumulated during the pandemic, the shortages are becoming more acute going into a holiday shopping season pivotal to America's economic recovery. Dozens of cargo ships are stranded off the coast of California and Georgia, unable to unload their goods because of pandemic-related labor shortages in the port and in trucking and trains. It can now cost as much as $25,000 to ship a standard container from China to the U.S., up from the usual price of about $2,500. Some stores are rationing essential goods. "I've been doing this for 43 years and never seen it this bad," said Isaac Larian, founder and CEO of toy-making giant MGA Entertainment. "Everything that can go wrong is going wrong at the same time." Why is this happening? There are multiple snags in the Byzantine process through which goods go from their origin points to our store shelves and Amazon boxes. About 90% of all consumer goods are shipped across oceans, with $1 trillion of them going from Asia to the U.S. Before the pandemic, companies embraced the much lower labor cost of making things in overseas factories, combined with a just-in-time global shipping process. But COVID-19 exposed a vulnerability that automation and mammoth container ships have not changed. The supply chain still heavily depends on human labor. Whether it's a shortage of longshoremen at California ports, truckers throughout the U.S., or a COVID-19 outbreak in Ho Chi Minh City, every supply chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Why are the shortages so bad? Manufacturing countries are still facing their own COVID-19 crises that keep workers out of factories. At the same time, severe shortages from the early days of the pandemic have cascaded through 18 months of manufacturers and retailers trying to play catch-up. In 2020, many Americans stuck at home decided to buy a new freezer to store food and or to replace overworked old appliances and or old furniture. But with supply weakened by COVID, the huge surge in demand led to months-long delays that haven't eased. If your refrigerator or dishwasher goes kaput today, you may not be able to have a new one delivered until spring. Despite hope that vaccines would help production return to normal in 2021, many people laid off early in the pandemic opted not to go back to their old jobs, citing low wages, overwork, boredom, and an unwillingness to deal with customers or coworkers who refused to wear masks or get vaccinated. Some trucking companies, unable to find drivers in the U.S., have started recruiting from Canada and South Africa. How will this impact consumers? Experts say Americans should expect continued shortages at supermarkets, pharmacies, appliance stores, and online retailers well into 2022. Retailers are scrambling to meet the usual surge in demand for the holidays, with American consumers expected to spend about $1.3 trillion from November to the end of the year, an increase of 7% to 9% over last year. Target, Gap, Pottery Barn, and others started promoting holiday decor and Christmas gifts in mid-September, worried that backlogs could keep them from meeting consumer demand in December. Experts believe toys and other in-demand Christmas items could be delayed by weeks or months. Supply chain woes have also led to rising prices and a spike in inflation. What is the government doing? The Biden administration launched a task force earlier this year to address supply chain challenges, promising to boost domestic production of medicine, batteries, and critical minerals. As ships lined up to wait for unloading berths in California, the White House named John Porcari, a former Obama administration transportation official, as its ports envoy. Porcari pushed ports to add night and weekend hours for trucks to pick up containers. But there may be too little time for everyone to adjust to a new 24/7 schedule. It takes time to unwind that kind of congestion. We don't have time, said Stephen Lamar, president of the American Apparel and Footwear Association. These are the kind of actions that should have been taken months ago. What else is being done? Mega retailers Walmart, Home Depot, and IKEA have begun chartering their own ships to get around the container backlog. The Italian fashion brand Benetton, citing a desire to regain control over its own supply chain, said it was moving production to Europe, Turkey, and Egypt, with a goal of cutting manufacturing in Asia by 50%. Logistics experts have started pushing for more automation in supply chains, but that could take years. Others are simply preaching patience. The price of lumber, which shot up over 300% this spring, has dropped 69% since May. Time for a few of the best columns. The first, the real meaning of Columbus Day. The second Monday in October has become a ridiculous political football, said Dominique Pino. At least 14 states and more than 100 local governments declined to celebrate Columbus Day this week, canceling the famous explorer in favor of Indigenous Peoples Day. The motive for this switch is perfectly understandable. To puncture the simplistic historical narrative that Christopher Columbus discovered a new world and civilized the savages. In reality, the 15th century explorer landed on islands and a continent already populated with a decent chunk of mankind, indigenous people he enslaved, tortured, and demeaned. But it's no less simplistic to reduce Columbus to a monster whose voyage to the Americas was nothing but an act of genocide. It should be possible to recognize that Columbus was both a deeply flawed man of his time and a courageous visionary who changed human history by introducing one continent to another. Besides, Columbus Day was never really about Columbus the person at all. It was created in the 1890s, a time of intense bigotry against Italian immigrants, to help facilitate the process of Italian Americans integrating into American society. That's progress worth celebrating, even if Columbus himself was no mythic hero. Protecting Utah's wilderness. Once again, a vast region of Utah's spectacular wilderness is under federal protection, said Stephen Trimble. President Biden last week officially reversed former President Trump's 2017 order opening up portions of the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments to oil and mineral exploration. At Biden's signing ceremony, Native American campaigners celebrated the conservation of their ancestral lands, while Utah's elected officials, nearly all white and male, bitterly complained that their dangerous and delusional dreams of fossil fuel bonanzas were spoiled. The plan to drill and mine in this spectacular region reveals These GOP officials' disdain for tribal sovereignty, as well as their disregard for the obvious need to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. The Utah congressional delegation falsely claimed the decision was opposed by Utah's citizens and native tribes. In reality, 74% of Utah's residents support restoring the monuments, and it was the broad indigenous coalition of five local Navajo, Ute, Hopi, and Pueblo nations that created the original Bear's Ear Monument and urged Biden to save it. Preserving this spectacular portion of our national heritage is a victory not just for the indigenous people who live there, but for all Americans and our descendants. This is an international column. Energy crisis. Nations struggle to keep the lights on. An unprecedented energy crunch is sweeping much of the world, said the Global Times from China in an editorial. As the pandemic recedes and global manufacturing ramps up, energy demand has skyrocketed, as has the price of oil, natural gas, and coal. Lebanon went completely dark for 24 hours this week after its biggest power stations ran out of fuel and its whole grid failed. And power companies in Europe, India, and the U.S. are warning there could be outages in the months ahead. Some Chinese provinces are already suffering rolling blackouts, with companies rationing the use of factory equipment and instructing workers to take the stairs, not the elevator. China's shortage has panicked businesses, said Primrose Riordan in the Financial Times. The country draws 70% of its electricity from coal, 90% of which is mined domestically. But Beijing has been shutting power plants for years because of environmental concerns and slowing production at coal mines as part of a workers' safety campaign. China is trying to make up for the loss with imports and has unofficially eased its ban on Australian coal, imposed a year ago after Canberra called for an investigation into the origins of COVID-19. Authorities are scrambling to boost coal production to keep the heat on this winter so angry citizens don't turn on the government. India would love to increase production, said V. Ramu Sarma in the Hans India, but it's not so easy. More than half of our 135 coal-fired power plants are running on fumes because of an intense monsoon season swamped our coal mines with rain and blocked key transport arteries with landslides. Importing coal is not an option since demand from China has driven global prices to record highs, with a 40% increase through August and September. The price of both oil and cooking gas are also up 60% this year, and ordinary Indians are desperately trying to buy alternative fuel sources such as cow dung and firewood. Why didn't the government prepare for this foreseeable crisis? Strategies to aggressively pursue use of renewable energy should have been in the pipeline by now. Europe is heading into winter with households paying five times the usual rate for natural gas, our main heating source, said Bjorn Fink. Usually, we can blame exporter Russia for high prices, but not this time. Last year's unusually cold winter drained our gas reserves, and Germany has been phasing out nuclear power. The renewables that are meant to replace those sources aren't yet up to the task. Wind turbines, for example, didn't produce as expected in a year without much wind. While the short-term answer is to suck it up and pay more for gas this year, the long-term solution is to reduce consumption and pump more funding into eco-friendly energy sources. That process will be expensive, laborious, and politically sensitive, and as prices rise in the meantime, we must ensure that the poor don't freeze. But there's an upside to this crisis. Juicy prices for the climate killers set exactly the right incentives for the rest of us to go green. Thank you. The last word, our feature article, is titled, Everyone Hated the Americans. In a village close to Kabul, Afghans face economic chaos, hunger, and strict Taliban rule, said Sudarshan Raghavan in the Washington Post. But after years of firefights and airstrikes, many villages are happy the U.S. left. The white flags flutter in the apple orchards of this serene hamlet ringed by oatmeal-colored mountains. They mark the precise spots where U.S. airstrikes killed Afghans. In Senzai's village, center lies the destroyed shell of a building that once housed shops. Down the road is a mangled, rusted car. There are white flags there, too. They're reminders of the legacy the United States has left in many rural areas across Afghanistan. Everyone here hated the Americans, said Zabiullah Hadiri, 30. His shop was shattered by an airstrike in 2019 that killed 12 villagers. They murdered civilians and committed atrocities. In Kabul and other Afghan cities, the United States will be remembered for enabling two decades of progress in women's rights and independent media and other freedoms. But in the nation's hinterlands, the main battlegrounds of America's longest war, Afghans view the United States primarily through the prism of conflict, brutality, and death. Here in Wardak province, 25 miles southwest of the capital, the U.S. military, the CIA, and the ruthless Afghan militias they armed and trained fought the Taliban for years. Trapped in the crossfire were villagers and farmers. Many became casualties of U.S. counterterrorism operations, drone strikes, and gun battles. A visit to the village of Senzai and the surrounding Nurk district offered a glimpse of life in post-American rural Afghanistan, home to nearly three-quarters of the population, where peace has emerged after 20 years of war. The visit offered clues to how the Taliban will govern the country and helped explain how militants were able to seize power across the nation so swiftly. They were abetted by the harsh tactics of U.S. forces and their Afghan allies, and by the corruption and ineffectiveness of the U.S.-backed Afghan government. Exacting any justice or compensation from the U.S. military or the government was elusive. So the killings of their relatives and the lack of accountability drove many villagers to support the Taliban. To be certain, the Taliban controlled the villagers through fear, intimidation, and their own brand of viciousness. But rural Afghan society is largely conservative, and residents mostly agreed with the militants' harsh interpretation of Islam. The villagers never got to see the other face of America, its generosity. Hardly any of the billions of dollars in U.S. aid that poured into Afghanistan reached Senzai, less than 2 hours' drive from Kabul. Reconstruction efforts outside the capital were thwarted by insecurity, corruption, and inefficiency, and the U.S. government's own watchdog agency concluded, homes in Senzai and nearby villages still don't have electricity or running water. The Americans left us nothing, said Khan Mohammed, the 32-year-old owner of a shop outside an abandoned U.S. military compound in the district center. Only that empty base. Still, with the departure of U.S. forces and the fall of President Ashraf Ghani's government, there's now a calm unlike the villagers have experienced in two decades. With the conflict ended and the Taliban in control, the violence has stopped. The major change is that there is peace and security now, and the killings of the people have stopped, Mohammed Omar, the village imam, said in front of a mosque peppered with bullet holes. You can move freely now anywhere. Death has disappeared. But any sense of relief is tempered by new woes. The Taliban takeover triggered freezes in funds in Afghanistan's central bank and humanitarian aid. International charities have pulled out of the district, and the economy is in freefall. There are no airstrikes, no night raids, no bombings, said Haderi, tall and wiry with a black beard and wavy hair. But the problem now is there is no work and no money. People here are facing hunger. Years before the airstrike that destroyed Haderi's shop and 16 other businesses, the people of Wardak were seething with resentment. Nationwide protests erupted in 2009 after U.S. soldiers allegedly burned a Quran, Islam's holiest text, during a raid at Wardak. The accusation was denied by the U.S. military. An Army Special Forces A-team was accused of killing at least 18 Afghan civilians between 2012 and 2013, prompting President Hamid Karzai to order the A-team out of Wardak and the Pentagon to launch an investigation. By then, Wardak was the site of the U.S. military's greatest single loss of life in the war. On August 5, 2011, Taliban fighters shot down a Chinook military helicopter in the Tangi Valley, killing 31 U.S. military personnel, 7 Afghan National Security Force members, and an Afghan interpreter. By 2015, U.S. forces were no longer based in the province. Still, the fighting intensified. U.S.-backed Afghan national and village-based forces, including at least one militia directed by the CIA, were battling the Taliban in Nirk. The Taliban by then controlled much of Nirk. The government was entrenched in the district center. The villagers were caught in between. Even mundane tasks became matters of life or death. If Haderi shaved, for example, would the Taliban consider him loyal to the foreigners and the government? If he grew out his beard, would the government or U.S. forces consider him a spy? Whenever we left our homes, we told our families goodbye, he said. We didn't know whether we would return home alive. The family of Sher Mohammed were inside their home in the village of Sarmarda in April 2019 when Afghan forces raided the compound. When his son refused to come out, Mohammed said, they called an airstrike on the house. His son's wife, their 3 children, and 2 other relatives were killed. The only survivor was his granddaughter, now 11. Mohammed said his son occasionally communicated with the Taliban like almost every villager, but he was not a militant. The day after the strike, the Taliban sensed an opportunity. The villagers were gathered, Mohammed said, in order to take the 7 corpses to the provincial capital, Maidan Shahr, to protest the strike. Why this? Why this? Some villagers chanted as they carried the bodies of the children, wrapped in white cloth, in footage shown on the Kabul news network. A month later, in the pre-dawn hours, airstrikes hit the shops in Sinzai and killed villagers in different parts of the hamlet. Witnesses described huge balls of flames and large plumes of dark smoke. By then, villagers said they knew the sounds of drones and U.S. bombers circling the sky. It was the Americans, Haderi said. No one else had such modern airplanes and drones. The villagers went to the governor's office to make a complaint and seek compensation for the damages to their shops. They never heard back, they said, adding to their resentment. The villagers acknowledged that 2 of those killed were members of the Taliban, but they said that 10 others were civilians. That made them angrier. Whenever the Americans came here and conducted raids or any operations against the Taliban, they indiscriminately fired at anyone, said Ahmad Khan, who lost his shop in the airstrike. That's why we all supported the Taliban. The Americans were killing the people while the Taliban protected them. In Kabul, Afghans were waiting to see how the Taliban will govern. In Sinzai, they already know. Life is governed by strict Sharia law, which the villagers embrace. It is acceptable here as it is divine and according to our Afghan values, said Omar, the imam. Girls are educated only until sixth grade. For decades before the Taliban first came to power in 1996, villagers said, no woman here had gone to secondary school or a university. On the rocky, unpaved roads, women float by in blue burqas that cover them from head to toe. They may be accompanied by a child in the village, but there are limits. She can't go by herself to the city without her husband or son to accompany her, Omar explained. Music and satellite dishes are banned, though few people have television sets because the only electricity is solar-powered and there's no normal antenna reception. Weddings are segregated and only women sing the traditional songs in their section. If we listen to music in public, the Taliban will beat us, said Ruhullah, 22, a grandson of Sher Mohammed, who, like many Afghans, uses one name. The Taliban have three-level court system and a police force, typically fighters not in uniform. These who are first-time offenders are given public whippings. No one can recall a time when the punishment was amputating a hand, as directed by Sharia. The militants tax the villagers, usually 10% of their farm production or store revenue. The Taliban have been relatively lenient by their hardline standards to avoid alienating villagers. Villagers may listen to music or watch movies inside their homes on smartphones. Some secretly pop up satellite dishes, Omar said. The militants have not enforced a requirement that men grow long beards. The Taliban's morality police patrol the village, but they preach about their dictates rather than using force, residents said. Now that the Taliban control the country, it remains to be seen whether they will clamp down harder in Sinzai. For now, the militants are basking in their glory. The victory is an achievement for all the people, said Mulavi Shafiqullah Zakir, 33. A Sinzai native, he was so enraged by the night raids and airstrikes that he said he joined the insurgency to wage jihad against the Americans. He's now the Taliban official in charge of the village. People who haven't seen each other in two decades are now traveling to far-flung areas to see relatives. But he acknowledged the militants face huge challenges. Poverty, which has always been deeply rooted here, is worsening. Prices of staple foods are rising. The few Western aid agencies that provided food, health care, and other necessities have left. There's only one doctor and a midwife. Medicines are scarce. Before, there were 4 to 5 doctors, one vaccinator, and a nurse in the village, Omar said. But after the Taliban took over, everyone has gone. Some people are hardly getting food for their families, Hadiri said. One man the other day told me that he has been boiling potatoes and eating it for the last 4 days. That has made Hadiri and other shop owners more resentful of the urban elites in Kabul. 2 years after the airstrike, they have been unable to rebuild their destroyed shops or properly feed their families. Yet they've watched millions of dollars flow to shady contractors and corrupt politicians in the capital. They say they are the same people who have fled with the help of the United States. Those who left Kabul, they did not leave Afghanistan due to hunger, Hadiri said. They have collected a lot of wealth, and they have gone to enjoy a luxurious life abroad. No one likes the Americans here, so how could those people be liked? Taliban fighters and pickup trucks now patrol roads dotted with banners that proclaim the nation free of foreign troops. Every day the fighters drive past the sprawling former U.S. military base in the district center, known as Combat Outpost Nurk. It sits like an ancient ruin. Visitors stroll through the silence, past dusty sandbags, strands of concertina wire, and other faded symbols of U.S. military power. America's legacy here haunts Shukrullah Ibrahim Kail. His younger brother, Nasratullah, was an alleged victim of the A-team. The Special Forces unit raided their home and grabbed him on a cold night, he said, and took him to the U.S. base. His family sought the help of tribal elders to secure his release. 2 days later, they found Nastratula's body near a bridge, badly tortured. Months later, the remains of 10 missing Afghan villagers were uncovered in graves near the base. The U.S. military denied the allegations. 2 years later, a criminal investigation was reopened. Cahill said he was called to Kabul to give testimony to the government, U.S. and U.N. officials. But after recounting the incident, he said he never heard back. The Pentagon did not respond to emails asking about the status of the investigation. Our demand was to punish those who were responsible for those killings, Cahill said. There was no justice done, nor was there any compensation for the victims' families. What can we do now when they have all gone? This story was originally published in the Washington Post. Thursday. Said Dave, and the